Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week and supporting public media. Election Day is Tuesday of next week. Early voting continues right now across the region. Tens of thousands of people are filling in their vote-by-mail ballots. Lots of people have already voted. Now, while there is plenty of focus on the November presidential election, a lot is riding on next week's local elections. Top prosecutor jobs, sheriffs, school boards, county and city leaders across the region are on the ballot. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the biggest races to watch, and we want to hear from you. What's driving your vote? Is it the pandemic, the response to COVID-19, criminal justice issues, climate change, the environment, taxes? 800-743-WLRN. Our voice line is open right now in the 1 o'clock hour on this Friday, 800-743-9576. Have you voted already? Tell us about that experience. You can also tweet us your story at WLRN. But first, this hour, an update on COVID-19 in South Florida. Almost 1,700 new cases were reported in the past 24 hours as of Friday morning in Miami-Dade County. 11% of those tested in the past day were COVID positive. The infection rate in Broward County on Friday fell to 7.6%, 6.5% in Palm Beach County, 10.5% in the Keys. In the past day, the virus has killed 86 people in South Florida. We spoke with Veronica Zaragovia, WLRN's healthcare reporter. Veronica, welcome back to the South Florida Roundup. Another busy week in terms of COVID news. On Wednesday, we saw twice the number of daily tests reported and the number of positive COVID tests in Miami-Dade County almost triple from the day before. It was a big spike in one day. What happened?
They say, Tom, that a lab provided what they call a data dump and that they hadn't had these numbers beforehand. And that's what caused this one day spike in numbers that we hadn't seen in the county for a while.
And so is it emblematic of the infection rate right now, or is this kind of just old information?
This tends to be old information. They say it dates back to late June. And so for now, both epidemiologists and officials in the state are not taking it like a warning sign that more things need to be, more businesses need to close or more measures need to be taken because it was this very rare incident. And given other numbers that we look at to determine how Florida is doing, because those haven't spiked up either, then it's for now safe to be confident that this was an anomaly.
Speaking of tests, we are seeing more testing sites using these antigen tests, not the deep nasal swab tests. What's the difference with these antigen tests that more sites are starting to use?
The main difference is the speed, and that's been a problem, as we know in Florida, that the results were taking too long to come back. And so the antigen test, it uses a mucus sample from the nose and can be available in minutes. It looks for the presence of proteins called antigens in a sample, and it's a cheap test. Results can come back in about 15 minutes. So that's an advantage, and they're being offered, for instance, in Miami-Dade County at Marlins Park and at Hard Rock Stadium. And they are especially effective when you have people who might have symptoms and they need to know pretty quickly whether they need to stay home because they have the virus. Whereas the molecular test looks for the virus's genetic material in a sample, let's say from the patient's nose, like those nose swabs. But the lab technicians need to use special chemicals. So there's a whole process there, and that takes a while depending on how backed up a lab is. And however, it's important to note that that the antigen tests, they are less sensitive than the PCR tests, which are the other ones that we've gotten used to. What that means is that it performs better in a high risk population. So if you're testing, let's say in a nursing home, where I'm just giving you a number, 10% of the residents have the coronavirus, then you can feel pretty confident with the positive results. But when you get a negative and you're testing a high-risk population, then experts worry that it's a false negative. And that's really dangerous, you know, because if you get a false negative, you're going out and around and about in the community and you can be spreading the virus. So that's why they're sometimes urging for a second test for maybe an antigen and a molecular test, these PCR tests, when you're dealing with a very sensitive population where you really need to get this right.
Testing is so important, and the turnaround of those tests so important. As we enter the back-to-school season, school districts and local leaders have pointed to a couple of different data points in order to make decisions. A 14-day average infection rate, that's an important statistic that folks are paying attention to decide reopening decisions for the economy as well as for school buildings. What's been the trend over the past couple of weeks for that statistic here in South Florida?
The positivity rate, it's been about 10% in most of the counties here in South Florida, in Palm Beach, Broward, and Monroe County. Miami-Dade is at a bit below 14% over the 14 days. But because we are really not low enough in South Florida, then the school districts in Monroe through Palm Beach County don't have to follow the mandate of reopening the actual school buildings. Students can still learn through, you know, remotely for now. And Tom, even as we watch these daily numbers and trends improving, we still hear from public officials who are reminding us that these measures that have been in place need to stay that way, like more people wearing masks and fewer gatherings and parties taking place, so that people just shouldn't change those ways. Otherwise, the numbers will go back up again.
What's been the trend for hospitalizations? Because that's been another key guidepost, and the number of available hospital and ICU beds.
The available ICU percentage is doing better this week for sure. In fact, Memorial Hospital System has already started offering its elective procedures, which had been canceled for quite a while. And we're hearing that Jackson Health System is in the process of opening those back up very soon. And so that's indicative that these hospitals are ready to admit more patients, and they've lost a lot of money in the process of canceling those procedures.
The return of those elected procedures is kind of a sign, maybe, of a return to some kind of normalization for hospitals. There was a concern a month or so ago about the ability of hospitals to have the personnel on hand. What's the state of nurses and doctors that may have been called to duty as we were seeing that spike up in cases in July?
I'm hearing from experts that it seems like these hospitals are managing, you know, where their staffing situation is returning to normal, because we haven't heard about the state sending temporary nurses, more of them, to these hospital systems. And so it seems like that problem is being alleviated. And I'm hearing that state and federal numbers for people hospitalized with COVID-19 have come down too. So I've been told that it's okay to have a sense of optimism about how our hospitals are doing for now.
For the most vulnerable population that a lot of folks have focused on, including yourself, what about the state of the virus here in mid-August for nursing homes?
I'm seeing that for nursing homes, both infected, that in nursing homes, both the number of positive residents and positive staff members has been in a decreasing curve. The Agency for Healthcare Administration is reporting about something like 5,400 positive residents starting on Monday, and that's been steadily decreasing, and it's about a similar situation for the staff members. This is a population where the virus can very easily spread, so some experts are worried about relying on an antigen test for having loved ones get visits from family members based on an antigen test. In case it's a false negative, that could cause a lot of problems with the spread of the virus all over again.
WLRN's healthcare reporter, Veronica Zaragovia. Thanks again, Veronica.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
The pandemic has changed how a lot of people are casting ballots this election season. There's been a sharp increase in the number of people voting by mail. Florida's primary election is Tuesday. That's election day. Early voting, though, continues now and through the weekend. We'll see what role, if any, the coronavirus pandemic has on voter turnout for this August election. This hour, we're previewing some of the major local races here in South Florida, and we want to hear from you. Do you plan on voting in the primary election? Perhaps you've already cast your ballot. Are you doing anything differently? What's driving the choices you're making? 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576. WLRN. We asked people about their voting experiences this election. Carl sent us this note of early voted in person. It helps that the polling station is at my work. Ann said that she mailed my ballot last week and checked our elections office website, saw that it had been received on election day. Ann writes, I'll check that it has been counted. And Bo sent us this tweet. I voted early in person. Very safe. Less people than at my local Publix. 800-743-WLRN. Scott in Loxahatchee is along with us. Go ahead, Scott. You're on the radio.
Hey, guys. Good afternoon. Yeah, we sent in our ballots yesterday up in Palm Beach County for a couple of reasons. Both my wife and daughter are cancer survivors, and it's just easier. We're not having to go into the voting area, and it's seamless. So it's easy to vote, seal it up, send it in.
You dropped it off at the post office or dropped it off at a polling station?
No, we actually mailed it in from our house.
You did. Great.
So, yeah. So, I'm a little frustrated because, I'm going to get partisan, so I apologize. I really see a lot of roadblocks that are being thrown up to try to stymie this for no good reason, and it really frustrates me. So,
Scott, I appreciate you sharing both stories with us. Good luck to you and your family. Scott in Loxahatchee there here on how he voted. Wilkin Brutus is with us now, WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter. Wilkin, lots of local races on the ballot that Scott voted on there in Palm Beach County. Perhaps one of the most closely watched races is the race for sheriff. Tell us a little about Rick Bradshaw running for his fifth term.
Hi, Tom. Yes. So the sheriff's Democratic primary is between incumbent Rick Bradshaw versus Alex Freeman. Now, Rick Bradshaw oversees the eighth largest sheriff department in the country. He's seeking his fifth four-year term. That's 16 years with a lot of experience, political influence, and controversy in the county.
And so what are some of those issues that are really bubbling up for voters? Obviously, Sheriff Bradshaw has a long record because he's been in office for a good long time.
Yeah, he has pretty much an extensive track record. He's, well-known in the county, has been quite active during Homeland Security and emergency management situations. His recent platform now deploys mental health field operations that de-escalate family disputes in the community. That's one of his key platforms at the moment. He also updated the use of force policy after the death of George Floyd, requiring deputies to hold EMS or to call EMS immediately once someone is hurt. But he certainly has, faced some huge criticism, particularly last year over the accused sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein's lenient work release privileges in the office's work release program. So a lot of history, a lot of controversy, but a lot of successes as well.
I also want to hear a little bit about the race for election supervisor. Palm Beach County was one of the counties that had trouble counting votes in 2018. And Governor DeSantis stepped in and replaced that election supervisor. Wendy Link was appointed by the governor. She is now running for election and facing a pretty well-funded challenger.
Yeah, as you know, Palm Beach County is the third largest in the state, and Broward and Palm Beach is known for its recount issues. So you may recall after issues with the voting recounts during the 2018 gubernatorial elections, Susan Booker was eventually removed by Governor Ron DeSantis and replaced by Wendy Link. And there are some, you know, interesting aspects to this. In March, around 800 poll workers didn't show up due to coronavirus fears. And that's huge considering the number of polling places. There are about 454 polling places. And so there are some concerns there. But according to the Palm Beach Post, she says early voting places, vote by mail has certainly increased security, but there are still some concerns.
Yeah, Palm Beach County is one of those places where we've seen an enormous jump in vote by mail ballots that have been received back already by the County Election Supervisor's Office ahead of Election Day. Let me also ask you about the 21st Congressional District. This is a primary. Lois Frankel, the longtime Democratic representative in the 21st from West Palm Beach, is facing a challenger. How serious is the challenge to Congresswoman Frankel?
Yeah, it's quite serious. He seems a bit formidable. He's part of a wave of young, his name is Guido Weiss, by the way. He's part of a wave of young grassroots progressives putting up a challenge against the incumbent Democrats. He's a former congressional aide on U.S.-Israel cooperation and an officer in the United States Navy Reserves. And he also was an office manager to Representative Tulsi Gabbard. So there is a national support on his part. Some of his policies are considered quite left on the Democratic ticket: Medicare for all, eliminating student debt, raising minimum wage. So these are popular policy platforms for young voters, and that's something I think voters should certainly consider when he's facing this incumbent.
And we've seen some of those Democratic members of the Florida congressional delegation finding themselves in primary challenges this August. Oftentimes it's from those challenges from the left as opposed to from the center. Wilkin Brutus, covering Palm Beach County for us here at WLRN. Thanks, Wilkin.
Thank you, Tom.
Taking your phone calls, taking your thoughts about this election cycle, 800-743-9576. Let's move down to Broward County. Rigo in Pompano Beach has called in. Go ahead, Rigo, you're on the radio.
Oh, yes, thank you so much. I'm calling in to let you know that I'm extremely excited for voting. I'm going to take time to early vote tomorrow in the primary elections.
You're going to go into the polling place?
I am. I didn't do the mail-in ballot early enough. But also with everything going on with the U.S. Postal Services, I plan on taking a day off to early vote in the general election in November, the few days prior. Just because I want to make sure that my vote is completely counted.
Rigo, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us. Thanks for tuning in and calling. Rigo in Pompano Beach there, 800-743-9576. We did ask listeners what's driving their votes. In Broward County and Davie, we heard from Natalia.
I'm voting in next week's primary and the general election in November for the future that we can have to be the future that we will have. I'm voting for leaders who will prioritize the needs of our neighbors over special interests. I'm voting to secure the integrity of our democracy and elections for those who will take a stance in line with the resounding science for the safety and security of our families in the wake of the overlapping crises of climate change and the coronavirus, for Medicare for All, and a Green New Deal. I'm voting for leaders who will acknowledge that we need to address systemic racism and oppression at the roots. My vote is my voice, and there's nothing that'll stop me from doing my part to make it heard.
Karen sent us this note on social media. I already voted in Broward. Broward Sheriff and Florida Representative are the two races I'm watching. What are you watching? What is driving your vote? What issues are you focused on with your ballot? 800-743-9576. Katie Swatowski covers Broward County with us here at WLRN. Katie, lots to get into in terms of the Broward ballot. Let's start, though, with the sheriff's race. The governor kind of is in this race as well, similar to the election supervisor race in Palm Beach County. Scott Israel was taken out of office by Governor DeSantis. Gregory Tony put into office. So Tony is running for his first election, so to speak, as sheriff, where Scott Israel, I suppose you could argue, is running for a re-election to an office that that he was kicked out of.
Hi, Tom. Yes. And that, you know, Karen is not alone in saying that the Broward sheriff's race is one that she's watching the most. I'm hearing that from a lot of voters. And the race has really turned into, there's three front runners. Yes, you have current Sheriff Gregory Tony. He has been surrounded by some controversy in recent months, which he's tried to use to his advantage. A past murder when he was 14, growing up in a rough neighborhood. He argues that makes him stronger as a person who understands crime. And then you have Scott Israel, who was removed for negligence and neglect of duty after the 2018 Parkland school shooting, which he is really trying to get his vote, you know, to be voted back in office, because his platform is based on that voters' votes were stolen when he was removed from office, that the will of the voters was circumvented by the governor, and he wants a second chance. And so you have those really, really strong personalities at play. And then you have a third front runner, Al Pollack, who was endorsed by the BSO Deputies Association. And that is significant because current Sheriff Gregory Tony has had a lot of problems with the union, particularly around disagreements and a vote of no confidence, actually, over providing PPE during the coronavirus pandemic. And so there's a lot at play.
There is. Glenna Milberg from Local 10 is with us as well. Glenna, welcome back to the South Florida Roundup. How are you seeing this sheriff's race stack up in Broward County?
Ooh, it's bitter and it is nasty. Thanks for having me today, by the way. Hi, everybody. The sheriff's race, the front runners, Gregory Tony as the incumbent, Sheriff Israel as the once and wannabe future sheriff. The two of them have just been riveting to voters just by virtue of the nastiness that's gone on. We were able to host both of them on our program this week in South Florida last Sunday, and they spent a lot of their time attacking each other, which I think Al Pollack is hoping to capitalize on, since he is, you know, he's retired and he is a 40-year law enforcement vet. But the thing about the Broward Sheriff's race, soon to be Miami-Dade in 2024, is that as an elected position, the law enforcer has to be a politician. Scott Israel is the consummate politician, and that is neither a positive or a negative. It is just a fact. And this is Gregory Tony's first race. There is a lot of attention on, as Katie said, the background that has surfaced on Gregory Tony. And I think what is important in that respect is not so much what happened in Philadelphia 27 years ago, but how he has handled it as he has entered the arena. There's a lot of evidence that whether by a sin of commission or a sin of omission, Gregory Tony did not put on the forms for application of law enforcement what he should have when asked about his past dealings with police as a teen. And, you know, that brings up a question of character and truthfulness that I think voters are looking to him to answer. Sheriff Israel has it's been a really difficult 2 years for him. He was pinned by the governor as being the buck stops here for all that went wrong in two mass shootings, Marjory Stoneman Douglas and at the airport in Fort Lauderdale. To his point, he had mentioned that he took this to a special master and a hearing, and a Republican special master says that he found no evidence that he should have been removed by the governor. Of course, the Florida legislature did not agree. And and so there you have.
There is a lot of background for each of these cases. And the Sheriff Tony situation in Philadelphia relates to when he was a teenager and was involved with homicide. With a man, and questions about the transparency that Sheriff Tony has had regarding that situation as he has continued on his law enforcement career. And Katie Swatowski, law enforcement is significant on the ballot in Broward County with the longtime serving state attorney's officer retiring, not running for re-election, really opening this office up for the first time in better than a generation.
More than 40 years, Tom. And Mike Satz is not running again after his very, very long career. But it's really interesting because this race, it really ties into the greater criminal justice system in the county, because it's not just the state attorney's office. It's also the long, long-standing public defender, Howard Finkelstein.
Right.
And the two of them together, I mean, one prosecutes crimes, one defends them. This has been an institution in Broward County that has not changed in a very long time. And now there are tons of candidates vying for this position and both of these positions.
Yeah.
So
eight
how they
for
work
the
together.
SAO officer and three for public defender.
Yes. And how they work together is going to either completely reshape what criminal justice in Broward County looks like, or, you know, we just don't know how that's going to go. And I should mention there's also a race for new clerk of court as well. So a lot could change in the Broward County Courthouse. And given State Attorney Mike Satz, I mean, after his long career, he declined to talk to WLRN for a story. But he was in the middle of prosecuting the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooters case.
Right.
And so those have been transformed over to Zoom hearings that have just been dragging on and dragging on much longer than the judge wanted to see them go on. Originally, the case was planned to go to trial sometime late this summer, and that's not happening because of the pandemic. So there's a lot that's up in the air there, particularly around these two races. And actually, our colleague, WLRN's Danny Rivero, he has a story running next week with a great insight on these two cases and what it means to have this changing of the guard.
Yeah, it's significant changing of the guard for Broward County, which has had these same folks in place for 15 years and better than 40 years in some cases. And then, Glenna Milberg, we've got the race for election supervisor. Broward County and election supervisor is a place that is in the hot seat each and every election day. And now we've got that on the ballot. What's at stake for this election in that supervisor's race?
Well, I think probably that and every election supervisor in the country at this point, there really needs to be some sort of ability to instill trust and security in voters. I mean, to say that the whole democratic process is at stake is probably not as melodramatic when you think about if people don't have trust in voting and that their ballot is going to be filled out and get to where it's supposed to go and counted properly, it's all over. And so Pete Antonacci, who was actually given that job when Dr. Brenda Snipes was taken out by the governor, he originally, I think people, especially in very Democratic Broward County, looked at him fairly skeptically as a person put in, a Democratic black female supervisor taken out and a Republican white man put in. There was great skepticism, but I think in the time that he has stewarded that and has said all along he will not be running for the position, I think he's made great strides in having people really place trust in his ability and the reforms that he's made and his ability to carry out this election. And so I think what's at stake is that the new Broward Supervisor of Elections really has to continue that trust, no drama in that department.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And just really make voters very confident that that process works.
Yeah, well, that's just one of the many kind of local, important local elections on the ballot in Broward County. Glenna Milberg with Local 10, stick with us. We want to talk about Dade County. Katie Swatowski, I know you got plenty more reporting to do at Broward County even on this Friday, so we'll let you go. Thanks, Katie.
Thanks, Tom.
Stick with us. We're going to talk about the races in Miami-Dade County and in the Keys. We also want to know from you, how are you voting? What's the process? Have you changed the way that you're casting your ballot because of the pandemic or other reasons? 800-743-9576. 800-743-WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for spending some time with us and supporting public media. We're talking about the August election. Election day is Tuesday. Early voting and vote by mail continue right now. We want to know what's driving your vote. What are the issues you care about? 800-743-WLRN. Lots of local races on the ballot. Which one has your attention? 800-743-9576. Paul sent us this tweet. I am voting in person. The Miami-Dade mayor's race is the one I have my eye on. John sent us this note. Paying attention to public transportation. After my first out-of-state trip, I was shocked Miami didn't have a real metro. Looking up why, I was ashamed to see we approved a tax, but our county commissioners have used the billions as a piggy bank, John says. I'm focused on the mayor's race. Uliani says that they voted in Miami-Dade County, where I was encouraged to vote because I wanted to vote for candidates that see the inconveniences that the county faces and how we're mounting up, especially during the pandemic. I'm personally keeping a close eye on the state attorney's election, just one of the many hot elections in Miami-Dade County. Alex is joining us from Miami Beach. Alex, thanks for joining the roundup. Your thoughts?
Hi, yes, I'm a 24-year-old voter. I've been voting absentee for almost 6 years. Oh, 4 years in from Colorado, and then I officially registered as a Democrat in Miami-Dade for the past 2 years and continued voting by mail for the convenience. I already voted, and I'm excited to see the Miami-Dade County Mayor elect the first female county mayor and also the state attorney's race. I'm very interested to see the outcome of that.
You're referring to Commissioner Daniela Levine-Cava, I imagine, in the mayor's race there.
Yes, definitely think she's a progressive and very experienced, and I like what she's done as a commissioner for the county, and also re-electing Commissioner Eileen Higgins for her initiatives with transportation and public housing. For the presidential election, I think I'm going to still vote by mail, but I will drop my ballot off at an outdoor drop box at a polling location because I think it's the safest and most secure thing to do for the presidential election during a pandemic.
Alex, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts and your process there. Certainly the mayor's race in Miami-Dade County is hotly contested. We asked listeners about what issues matter to them. David from Miami is also focused on a good number of races, including the state attorney's race.
Hey, WLRN, this is David. I'm a longtime resident of Dade County, proud alum of Miami-Dade County Public Schools, MDC, FIU, and currently getting my master's at UM. So it's 3:05 till I die over here. I love this community, man, but it's time for us to make some changes. You know, our country's really been grappling with social and racial injustice this year, and we have an opportunity to move the needle this election. And so this year, I want to vote out our 27-year incumbent at the state attorney's office who has never brought charges against law enforcement. It just isn't right.
David sharing us his thoughts from Miami, talking about the state's attorney's office race in Miami-Dade County. Danny Rivero is WLRN's reporter who has paid a lot of attention to this top prosecutor race. He joins us now, Glenna Milberg from Local 10, and This Week in South Florida is still with us. Let's talk about the top prosecutor job first. Danny, this is quite the race. 27-year incumbent. Catherine Fernandez Rundle against a former lieutenant, former prosecutor in her office, Melba Pearson. How do you see this shaking out?
Right. Well, this is, one of those races that everyone seems to be talking about. Both candidates are Democrats. The final results of the election will be decided on the primary because there are only two candidates for that race. It's shaping out to be both have strong support on different avenues. You know, the incumbent, Kathy Fernandez Rundle, has a lot of institutional support. She's been around for a very long time. People know her name. They know her very well, better or worse. She's been around. And on the other side, we have Melba Pearson, who, as you mentioned, was a longtime prosecutor under Kathy Rundle. And she's really gotten a lot of support by young people. Her flyers were being passed out in marches and protests that have been happening lately. There's been a lot of publicity, even stories that I've done, calling some of the practices at the current state attorney's office into question. The Democratic Party itself in Miami-Dade County actually asked Kathy Fernandez Rundle to step down and to step aside after 27 years. It's gonna be very tight. I would not want to make a call on it, but it certainly is a very strong challenge that the incumbent is facing in this election.
Clinton, you've had both of the candidates on. You've been watching this race, covering this race. What strikes you about the tone of the race and the choices that voters have?
Well, the tone of the race has it started a little testy and probably has gotten worse. I will say, though, it could be much worse than it is in the grand scheme of these elections, especially in Broward. But something I will say just caught my eye. David, one of your listeners, who talked about how Kathy Fernandez-Rundle has not brought any charges against police officers. That was really interesting to hear, because there is a narrative in this race, and I think it had resonated, and that actually isn't true. She has brought charges against police officers, just never a murder charge against an on-duty police officer. And in context, really, neither has any other prosecutor in Florida very much. There has been some, but, I mean, fractionally.
So there's one in Palm Beach County from a couple of years ago.
Only one conviction in Florida in, you know, a few decades, I think, is the number. So that in itself is not unusual, but the narrative in this race, and especially on the heels of George Floyd and the whole police reform movement, I mean, that message could not have come at a better time for a candidate like Melba Pearson. That is her platform. And so the timing for her candidacy and her platform was just perfect to get out that kind of narrative. And I think people are plugging into the narrative of each. But here's what's really interesting about this race, if I could. This is a Democratic primary, but there is no Republican candidate, and so it's open. And one of the very few races, maybe the only one, that Republicans can vote in. And Melba Pearson is a very progressive candidate, as we've been talking about, as Danny was mentioning. It'll be interesting to see what the conservative voter will do here.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. A primary, but it is on all ballots in Dade County, Republican, Democrat, and no party affiliation. So it's there. Let's talk about the mayoral race, speaking of nonpartisan races. This is a crowded field with three current commissioners vying for an office that the fourth candidate used to occupy before it was a strong mayor position. Glenna, how do you see this race moving along, likely into a runoff into November, you think?
I'm not sure I'm qualified to make that assessment, but by all indications, yes. I mean, you've been looking at the internal polls by a couple of the candidates that showed that particular candidate ahead, but not by much. And so I'm not quite sure how much faith I put in those, respectfully. But what's really interesting about this race, and people have been asking me, what do you think? Are they qualified? And I think really every one of those four top runners are qualified to be mayor, and it depends on what your perspectives and policies and politics are, because most of them are very different. Daniel,
yeah, a nonpartisan race, but there's a lot of politics here. Yeah,
exactly. It's a nonpartisan race, but if you look at someone like the candidate Steve Bovo, Commissioner Bovo, who is the only, even though it's a nonpartisan race, he's the only conservative Republican in the race, and he has been campaigning as such. I think even today he was campaigning with Senator Marco Rubio by his side. And so he is making a play for the conservative vote. Daniela Levine Cava, comes from a social service background, a nonprofit organizer, longtime progressive, and interestingly enough, you have Xavier Suarez, a commissioner who is the only NPA, voter affiliation, and Alex Pinellas, for people who have been around a couple of decades, has a very interesting role as a Democrat in Miami-Dade, whether his, Elian, the whole Elian saga that people may remember.
Elian Gonzalez. Sure. When Alex Pinellas was mayor of Miami-Dade County.
Yes. And so, you know, that and Al Gore and the Bush v. Gore 2000 election called Alex Pinellas, who did not throw enough support his way, the single most treacherous, dishonest person. You know, will that resonate with longtime voters?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. But we'll have to see. It was 20 years later. But let me get Danny in real quick, just on the commission itself, because you've got four commission seats on the Miami-Dade Commission out of 11 here, Danny. So there's going to be quite a sea change in the faces and the politics on the board itself, perhaps after Tuesday.
That's right. I was actually interviewing someone the other day and talking to them, and they said, you know, this is the biggest realignment in Miami-Dade County's government that we've seen in decades. And I thought about it and I looked at it, and that's actually absolutely true. You know, this in the 90s there was a reapportionment where all the seats in the county commission were once elected countywide, and then they mm-hmm. went to individual districts, and that brought about a whole sea change in the way that the county was represented. And now, because of term limits, and because, you know, you have someone like Commissioner Suarez who's leaving his seat to run for mayor, we could have a potentially brand new commission here.
Yeah.
The dynamics on it, of it, depending on who wins which seat, you know, it could be, you know, it could trend definitely more progressive, more liberal, or cut back very conservative. And it really is all up in the air. I mean, we'll see.
We will. It's just one of kind of the overall comprehensive things to watch. Danny Rivera with WLRN, Glenna Milberg with Local 10. Thanks to both of you for walking through some of those local races. Let's head down to the southernmost bureau. Nan Klingener joins us now from Key West, because there's a big mayoral contest there happening. Nan, what are the big issues for the Key West mayor position?
Well, it's kind of a referendum on the current mayor, Terry Johnston, who is running for re-election after her first two-year term. And of course, for the last few months, it's all been about the pandemic and what measures she's taken to deal with it.
And the cruise ship question is not on the ballot here in August. It will be in November, but I have to imagine that question is still in the air, isn't it?
It is, and she differs from the other two candidates in the race on that. They all say they support the one question that would prioritize ships by those with the best environmental and health safety records, but she's the only one who said she thinks it's a good idea to limit the number of passengers and the capacity of ships that come.
Do you think the mayoral vote on Tuesday is kind of an early indication of what that vote on the cruise ship referendum could be in November?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a big difference in the candidates.
What other races in the Keys that you'll be watching on Tuesday?
Well, there's a Republican primary for a county commission race. Those are elected countywide, and there is an independent candidate, so it won't be settled finally on Tuesday, but that independent candidate has run before in the Keys and has traditionally not gotten a lot of votes. So I think we're seeing the likely winner that comes out of that, and that's the Upper Keys seat. And the candidates there are the current mayor of Isla Mirada, Mike Forster, mm-hmm. and Key Largo businessman Robbie Majeska.
Nan Klingener, thanks for walking through some of the Keys politics here that's on the ballot. It'll be interesting to watch on Tuesday.
Thanks, Tom.
We've got more to come. We're going to move away from politics for our last 10 minutes or so and talk about the environment. You may have seen this story if you're on social media. It probably showed up in your timeline one way, shape, or form. Dead fish, scores and scores and scores of them in Biscayne Bay. What's killing the fish in the bay? We're going to talk about that next on the South Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. A neighborhood swim club was out for their morning swim on Monday in Biscayne Bay when Catherine Mikesell noticed a few dead fish in the water. She first thought they were just bait fish and swam on.
And all of a sudden we realized that we were literally surrounded by dead fish. And we're like, oh my gosh, this is a far bigger problem. That was not bait fish there. This is a major problem.
Dead fish have been found this week from Virginia Key in the south to the north side of Miami. Christopher Boykin is the director at the Pelican Harbor Seabird Station on the 79th Street Causeway. He shared video of what he saw.
Here we have hundreds of southern stingrays and of checkered puffers. There were even butterfly rays, which I've only ever seen twice in my life. And it goes on and on and on and on and on.
It was a remarkable scene, if you saw this on your social media timelines, the bottom of the bay crowded with stingrays near the shoreline, probably where the waves were crashing up, trying to help increase oxygen in the water, looking for oxygen, those stingrays were. Jenny Stiletovich covers the environment for us at WLRN. Jenny, have you ever seen anything like that before?
I have not. I've never seen so many stingrays along the shore. And there were some questions at the beginning like, oh, are they here to breed? But clearly they weren't.
yeah, not there to breed, but to breathe, rather, right? Yeah,
right,
no, it
exactly.
was remarkable. So, and then, you know, we saw yard upon yard of fish floating in the water in places in the bay. What do we know on this Friday about what may have killed them or contributed to their deaths?
Well, they're still documenting high temperatures and low oxygen levels in the bay. A lot of the fish are washing up along the western shore between like 79th Street and down just past the Venetian Causeway. They don't know if they're landing there because of winds and current or where the die-off actually is. Miami Waterkeeper is taking reports from people. They've got a map that shows you can link to, and people are describing what they see. And then Florida International University has actually been going out and monitoring the water. They have a buoy now, just below the 79th Street Causeway. You can go on and look at the data live. It's kind of cool. But you can see how the oxygen levels are really, really low. Like last night, they dropped down to below zero, which I didn't think could happen.
Below zero, negative oxygen? That's, never heard that before. But what causes that? Is it the heat of the water? Is it like just decaying matter on the bay of the floor of the bay?
Right. So when the water gets really hot, the oxygen levels drop. But it's more than just temperature that can drive down oxygen levels. If you have plugs of fresh water, that heavier fresh water can prevent the water from mixing. And it's the mixing that helps oxygenate the water, which is why the rays were up along the shores where the waves are. Mm. I think mm-hmm. the key thing now, what everybody's trying to do, is connect the dots in how we got here. Every summer, the water gets hot, you know, oxygen
right.
levels
yeah,
drop.
That's not news. What about pollution? Is that a role? Does that play a role in it? The water quality?
Yes. I mean, and that's, we have a chronic problem with pollution. Last year, NOAA said we're in the midst of this regime shift. They looked at 20 years of data that showed chlorophyll and algae gradually creeping up as we get more pollution from stormwater, fertilizer, leaky septic tanks. So again, they're trying to connect the dots. The problem is it's very difficult to point to one single thing when you have conditions like this. There's been a lot of water coming out of the Little River. Waterkeeper shared a map with me that came from the South Florida Water Management District that shows just tons. I mean, like twice as much fresh water, three times as much fresh water coming down the Little River. And again, that fresh water can prevent the kind of mixing that fish need. Yeah. But why are they flushing so much water down the Little River? You know, why do we have increased stormwater? I mean, these are the kinds of big picture questions that need to be answered.
A year ago, the Miami-Dade County's Biscayne Bay Task Force declared that the bay was in a state of emergency. Has the task force opined on what we've seen just this week with these fish kills?
So the task force has actually the draft final report ready to go. I've seen a copy of the draft, but they're working on getting, and I was told yesterday in the next couple of days, they may issue the draft recommendations. The task force tends to look big picture and not at like these specific instances. That's something that DERM goes in and investigates. There's something
DERM
else
is the
that's
Department
out.
Of Environment Regulation
Sources Management
like
Division. Yes,
resources, right. Thank you. Okay.
And so in 2018, the county commission, Danielle Labine-Cava, actually asked for a report card, asked for them to start producing a report card on specific conditions so we could see how the bay is doing. There's a draft of that report card. I've been told this morning that it's on the mayor's desk, but it hasn't been issued yet. I mean, there are, again, it's connecting the dots. Everybody is wondering, you know, NOAA said we were at this sort of regime shift point. Is this a tipping point that scientists like get very nervous about?
Of course, yeah. Regime change has been used. State of emergency has been used to describe Biscayne Bay. And then the story of the Monday morning swim club finding themselves amidst just scores of dead fish during a regular morning exercise. Just remarkable to see some of that footage come out and reporting as well, Jenny. Thanks for sharing it with us here on the Roundup. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Jenny Stiletovich, WLRN's environmental reporter, joining us here on the South Florida Roundup. Our program is produced by Alexander Gonzalez and Denise Royal. Our engagement editor at WLRN is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio programming at WLRN is Jason Zabka. The director of radio operations and the program's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. We want to remind you that Election Day is Tuesday. Early voting is ongoing through the weekend. Vote by mail ballots are out. Those need to be in a polling place or the election supervisor's office by the close of voting on Tuesday. You can find more information about the candidates and voting procedures, vote by mail procedures, on the website at WLRN.org, and also follow us on our social media streams on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Look for WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for calling, listening, and supporting public radio. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.